session number 27226, reel 15.
Final hook, reel 15.
Okay. Right. Well, after Airfield Errol, we went straight down to Yeovilton and straight on to Hurricanes on general experience flying, and we flew the Hurricanes without dual controls at all from day one. It was an operational exercise to teach you combat flying in combat aircraft in the Navy. The Hurricane was used because it was a rugged aircraft, but these aircrafts that you were liable to go onto from a Hurricane when you left Lovington could be anything, any of the American aircraft that was coming forward now, which the Martlets, which were still around early on in the affair, Wildcats, Hellcats, which were very, very fine and very rugged aircraft, designed for carrier work, and the Corsair, which was actually designed for the American Marines who couldn't fly it. And we got them, and they turned out to be the best aircraft of the lot. A beautiful airplane in the air, and solid but light. It was amazing how a big, heavy aircraft like that could fly so well. And of course, it was a radial engine, as all American aircraft were. It would... they would fly at 4.5 hours for 4.5 hours, which is a long time, you know, and they could carry a load as well. And if they hit anything, anything usually got hurt. They were quite good. But that's an aside from what we were doing at Yeovilton, which was flying the Hurricanes in training in combat conditions, for which we had an instructor who took us up doing the exercises, telling us what to do, following ground instructions, and following what happened in Errol, where we were doing these things like quarter attacks and so on and so forth in an easier aircraft with an instructor in the back. So it was quite a natural follow-on from the advanced flying unit and the transition from, you know, stooging and swordfish, where you got a lot of good flying experience, but not the sort of experience you need for combat work. So we now go to the two squadrons at Yeovilton. One is the initial transition to fighter operations, and then the practicalities of fighter operations, like fire gunning, firing, deck landing, and so on and so forth. Through all this, of course, there's not just that, but there's radio, telephone, telegraphy, visual signals, and the ancillaries relating to flying an aircraft in ship conditions. Not straightforward. It's not like flying an aircraft into an airfield all the time. So we're now looking at 760 Squadron was the first one, and we had instructors, and I was lucky. My instructor was Dickie Cork, who was DSO, DFC, about whom we can tell a lot of stories if we want to. But he was Dougie Bader's wigman, and a lot of people don't realise or haven't realised that there were an awful lot of Fleet Air Arm pilots in the Battle of Britain, something like 30-some, and not one of them survived the war. Even Dickie Cork was killed in a monstrous accident, which I'll deal with when we go to East Africa. But that, again, I'm lucky because that probably saved my life, because I was going to join him in 1833 Squadron of the Illustrious, which got battered. And while I was still in East Africa, he was killed. So that's another story which will come on in its proper sequence. But Dickie was... he was an excellent instructor. Loved airplanes. He was born and brought up with the damn things, I think. And he was the nicest guy. He was a Fleet Air Arm pilot per se. He, even when he was in the fighter wing, one of his strengths was the fact that he was responsible for people and teaching them how to fly. And he took it very seriously and very practically. If you did something wrong, he showed you why it was wrong and you got it out of your system. It's hard to describe, really, but he was an instructor that instructed. And he didn't just fly around. There were other instructors, which I can name, at Yeovilton, who were anything but, you know. They just arrived there. They didn't want to twitch up to the eyeballs. And they got involved in instructing, and they were not good for you. Because it's a question of relationships, of course. And you can smell these things, you know. You can smell the ones that are right and smell the ones that are wrong. It's an instinct. You get it. It's part of flying, I think. You know when somebody's good and somebody's right. He does things thoroughly. He looks around and sees the tires aren't going to be holes in. And we came up into this in later on in Ceylon, where the relationship with the crew, I always said, was important, and it was quite clear there. And when I got back to England later on, after being away with Marines, the attitude of Marine COs were different. They were trying to run a disciplined force, and fighter pilots aren't different, disciplined. And you spoke with your crew, you worked with them, and even when hurricanes, where you didn't have to turn wheels or anything silly like that, it always paid you to talk to the boys, because they knew what the engines were doing as well. And there was still that division, but there was a camaraderie there, because the lads were proud of the aircraft and proud of the people who were flying them.
With Dickie Cope, did he impart to you lessons on combat experience that he'd had?
Oh yes, yeah. He was. I can think of one particular situation where we were doing dogfighting, which is the thing you do with flying. I mean, you flew an aircraft all upside down, which way up, and didn't really matter. Close formation and that sort of nonsense. I'll tell you a story about close formation later on. But I remember one particular situation where we were doing quarter attacks, and he was demonstrating, bearing in mind he's another aircraft and he's good at it, and you're sitting there waiting to be attacked by somebody who comes along. And he came along with his aircraft, and you saw that he was sitting there, and you knew where he was, and if he was firing a gun, you're dead. You knew from that. And this is only one personal experience of mine. And of course, as soon as I saw him, I moved, but quite gently, bearing in mind that I'd been flying aircraft where you never took them to the limits, you never stressed them at all. We did just bits and pieces and exercises, but you never thought of really ramming home the throttle and pushing everything forward and going a screaming dive or doing silly like that. And I saw him and tried to evade him, and I couldn't get away from him at all. He was just there. When he got back, so Gordon, he said, don't fly your aircraft anymore. He said, just use the throttle and do what you want to do with it. He said, that's the key. He said, don't think about the aircraft blowing up, the engine going wankers, if the engine being anything like that. If you're in trouble, the engine's going to be no bloody good if somebody set a bullet in it. Ooh. Yes, Dickie. So that was it. Next day, we were flying around doing this quarter attack, and he came down to a quarter attack, and I was in the right same position over there, but I wasn't there then. And he said, shit. That's all he said. He said, that's the way to fly, Mokey.
So what had you done?
Pardon?
What had you done?
Well, all I'd done was I'd seen where he was and see where he's coming, and I just pulled back on the stick, put full hard rudder on, and opened the throttle wide. Bang. And everything coarse. No, nothing smooth, nothing silky, nothing. Wham, bang, thank you, ma'am. And by the time I was upside down and on, I was round on his arse. He was surprised. We never got into that situation again because he knew what I was going to do, and he knew what to do before. But I gave him a hard time. Now, that's my instructor, the best in the business, and I was going to join him anyway, so, you know, he accepted the fact that I was reasonably good.
So he sounds to me like he was advocating just use your instincts to get away or to put yourself in a better position rather than attempting to fly by the book.
Exactly that. Exactly. The book's gone out of the window. You've got an aeroplane, you've got an engine, and when you're flying, you get that engine to do everything it can in the way you want it to. And he told us a story when he was on Force 18, that was the big convoy into Malta, how they came back and there's no compression left in the engines at all. They could spin the propellers down. You know, that had gone. And they just kept the engines open all the time. They were flying hurricanes and sea hurricanes. And that's a solitary, it's something that people don't tell you about, you know. And he saw that was happening and he knew that how to solve it. And he just told me, Gordon, he said, don't worry about your engine, don't worry about being course flying, don't worry about sweetness, just bash it in. And you did, and it made a difference. Made a hell of a difference to my flying, completely and utterly, because I knew then that I didn't have to worry when it, you know, when I pushed it wide open. If the engine blew up, that was hard luck, you know? And it's something you can't learn, you've got to be told.
Sounds like a moment of insight, almost, yeah, that he gave you there. Yeah. You said that obviously he was a good instructor who could give you that sort of insight.
Yeah.
And you touched on the poor ones. Would they not impart any information at all?
Well, I take you to that, to the next one. My Dickie Cork left while I was still there, and I got an instructor called Allingham. And when I mention Allingham to anybody now, I always say, Alan was a bastard. Oh, Christ, yes, he was. He was a fool. Now, okay, this is criticism a long time afterwards, but he was a two-ringer, I was a sub-lieutenant learning, so I couldn't... Took four of us up in hurricanes through stratus cloud for 18,000 feet. One man in the front, him, so he doesn't know what's going on either side of him, and number four in the box, me. 4,000 feet in fog. Every so often the fog disappears and you're clear, and then you go in. And when you're sitting there, you've got a mincing machine in front of you, a tail in front, you're in fog. It's bad enough in a car, in an aeroplane with a propeller in front of you, that's hairy. We got to 18,000 feet and I lost it. Okay? Which is fair enough. So what did I do? There's three people there flying an aircraft. The bloke in front's got three people. He doesn't know that I'm not there anymore. He can't know. Because, he can't see what's gone out. I was sitting behind and below him. Sorry about this. But at 18,000 feet, I lost it completely. So what did I do? I said, I can't hang around here, we're in cloud. I don't know how much further we're going to go. So I went down, turned around, went back. Because I'd made a mental note. I always had a pencil and I always draw lines on the rubber from the front of major change of direction. You could do that quite easily when you're flying. And I just turned around and went back. I went back to Yeovilton. He went all the way to Brighton or somewhere up the coast and got lost completely. Had to bring them all back through 18,000 feet. I was sitting in there, I had my lunch by the time he got back, he was lost.
And that just illustrates a different form of instruction, though. Was that just, you will follow me, attitude?
Well, that's right. He was taking up through 18,000 feet. We weren't even briefed what we were going to do. I just had to follow him. Now, in a situation like that, one of the most important things at any time, when you're going for an exercise that requires something different, you explain to people what the problem is. He never did. So some people could have learned that lesson the very, very hard way. But a lot of people they would have had trouble. They would have been in real strife. So I got logged as below average for airmanship for that. And I've been teaching airmanship to observers at Arbroath. So I fell out of love with, I got to below average, which I didn't like. But taught me a lesson too, that at the end of the day, you're alone, you're by yourself, you have to make decisions. And if you don't make the decisions, and if they're the wrong decisions, but you get away with it, nobody's going to hurt you. They can't. And of course has made him look a fool, because he didn't tell me where I was. He didn't tell me where we were going, what we were going to do when we got there, and how we were going to get back. What would happen if we'd broke? Never, nothing like that at all. It's wrong. That's the difference between good instructing and not. And the net result is that he did some save my life. I can't complain about that. But he penalised me as well, I think. But there was no question, really. He didn't go back. I don't think he went back into first line fly mode. Dickie Cork became the chief of Symphony Fighter Wing. And so it didn't really matter, but we lost it completely, as you'll find out later on, because when we left Yeovilton, there weren't any aircraft carriers at all. They're all away being repaired and everything else. And the new lot were just coming out, the Indom and Defats and all that.
Do you think that he'd been given the instructing role because he wasn't a particularly good operational pilot?
Oh, I can't say that. He didn't know how to handle people. I think that was a real problem. Because if you're instructing people, you've got to be able to talk to them, relaxed at a one-to-one level, you know. He couldn't. We were sprugs going into a situation where he's been in operations, and he couldn't bridge the gap between the two. I think that was fundamentally a real problem.
You mentioned there that you were doing formation flying. Mm-hmm. What formations were you doing when you were doing this training?
Well, we do type formation. We used to... we do four in the box. We used to close formation two and two, and we also used to go formation flying aerobatics as well, which was not funny. There were usual things like barrel rolls, was quite easy, or you follow somebody all the way down. And the hurricanes that we had, they weren't, you know, super duper powerful things, you know, they had to be flown very carefully. But we were taught everything, formation flying and tight formation, which was good and healthy. Normal close operations, side by side.
Is there anything when you're doing that you have to look out for when you're formation flying?
Not really. The position, the throttle control is your real problem, because you're doing this all the time to keep yourself alongside, and if you're tight, it's a little bit tricky.
So it's constant adjustment.
With adjustment of the throttle
to keep together.
You can't just stick it there and say, well, that's it. You know, you have to be using that.
You mentioned the term four in a box. What does that mean?
One in the front, one either side on the wing, and one in the tail of the one in the front. It's a tight wall. You see, you can't go that way. Can't go that way. Can't go that way.
With the Fleet Air, did you have any different types of formations, really, from, say, the RAF formations that were flown?
I think that came really into squadron work. But the normal way of flying was two and two, one on either side. If you find one by himself, you just go behind him. You just shoot him down if he's behind him, or if he turns to the right, he gets him, and turns to the left, he gets him.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Hurricane as an aircraft? What it looked like, and what the cockpit layout was, and how you found it to fly?
The Hurricane was a very comfortable aircraft, but it was very rugged in a non-rugged sense, because the bodywork, the fabric, the tail end was a fabric. The front end was metal, if I remember rightly. Sliding hood, very forgiving airplane. Good wide undercarriage, which is unlike the Spit, which had a very narrow undercarriage. You could certainly see over the front of it. Flew nicely, handled well, no vicious characteristics, spun very well. Engines were sound, it was a usual Merlin, but it was a Rolls-Royce inline engine. Required coolants, so it could have problems there. Now, I never had any problems with the Hurricane with cooling, but I did with Fulmer's. When I was at Yeovilton, where Stone went through the cooling radiator, that sort of thing. So we lost all your coolant, and then you got overheating.
With the Hurricane, would you use an oxygen mask?
Oh, yeah.
For the heights you were dealing with? Cause
oh, yes, no problem. When you went high, you were going over 15,000 feet, you automatically put yourself on oxygen at ground level and flew all the way up. It didn't bother me. Because we were tested at Yeovilton for anoxia, and I was not a problem, strangely enough, but I used to fly at 25,000 feet without oxygen in Ceylon because it was so hot in the cockpit and I didn't need it. And I used to, I'll tell you why. When we, at Yeovilton, we go through a series of tests, and one of the tests was being decompressed, where they take us up to a series of levels in a decompression chamber, and as you get higher and higher, the oxygen gets less. And they make you write your name on a sheet of paper with a rule. Have you heard this one?
Yeah.
And you write your name, and they take you up, and you're decompressed. And gradually, you go along, and people fall away. I'm a funny bugger, I'm different. They put me in the chamber, and people used to say about your fingers going by. I don't remember that at all. But I was sitting there writing, no oxygen mask at all. And I was writing my name, L. Hook. And the boys were watching in the portholes, and they said it was horrible to watch. I never stopped moving. It took me up to 35,000 feet, and I was still moving. And they thought they'd gone too far, and they put an oxygen mask on my face. And immediately, not even a fraction of time at all, I was writing my name normal. It took me to 35,000. Nobody ever gone that high without oxygen, ever. And I was still moving. Arising from that, recently I had a cerebral hemorrhage. I was smashed in a car. You knew about that, didn't you? And they still can't understand why I only was unconscious for 4 days and I came around so quickly. And I maintain that my oxygen globules were powerful enough that when my blood flow to my brain stopped, and apparently there was still pressure there, even though there was a little bit of it, I still had sufficient oxygen in my bloodstream to give me recovery, even if it'd take a long time. And I've mentioned this to the docs, and they said, yeah, probably, yeah. Just my own metabolism. My brother had his arms blown off during the war. He had his right arm blown off when he was 11. I was in West Africa then, and he had he got a thumb and a little finger in his left hand. That happened at about 4:30 after school, and they found him at 8 o'clock at the beach with all the blood frozen on his arms. So he lost the arm here, blown off completely, and that off. I got him into hospital. He's alive today, as fit as a flea, and he can sail a boat, drive a car, ride a bike. That's all he's got. Runs his own business. And I maintain that was something in our blood system. And I've got a very good blood clotting potential as well.
What other tests did they give you while you were? What other tests did they give you while you were at Yeovilton?
Well, the tests is we've got IQ tests as well. Did you not know that? You've never heard that one. Well, it was the early days when they were doing IQ tests, and we got onto IQs. We don't know what they were at all. Oh, this is ego trip, really. It's ridiculous. But again, I did this thing, and it was just, you know, the usual. It's really the Mensa tested in a similar format against top 1% of the country, according to the Rennes who were doing it. And I still don't know why, but that was one of the tests that they did. And I think some of these things must have been looked at in our things, in our books later on, because I got stuffed into jobs that other people wouldn't get stuffed into. Don't know why, but but I never got to the top, did I?
Were you tested on your flying and your combat tactics and that sort of thing as well?
It was done by your instructors, and they made their assessments as you were going on. Your flying assessment, when they were not looking at your flying, they were looking at the way you flew, and they made their own assessment, and they flew in relation to what they wanted you to do later on. There was, I think, always the ability to control your aircraft in the right conditions was there. But it was a different development aspect of flying, really. You were flying a killing machine, and you had to fly it within limit, you know, extreme limits sometimes. I think that's essentially the difference. And bear in mind, you can't get all the instructions the same. They all have different attitudes, so different experiences. Different attitudes to people. I mean, Douglas Bader was never the best instructor that ever was. He was not. He was authoritarian, and he would do it my way or else. But he was still a good leader. It's just a question of types, really. And you don't have to be authoritarian to lead people, especially if the people like fleet Navy pilots, who are essentially intelligent for a start. I think that's quite important, because if you look at the fleet air arm as a group of people now, my generation, they go out to help each other purely and simply because they've all been through the same experience. Even if they weren't on operations, they've all had to fly naval aircraft in naval aircraft conditions. Difference, because all the RAF do is take off from an airfield and come back to it. And you, if you're associated with the Navy, you're not just flying an airplane, you're living on a ship.
Very interesting, because obviously it brings up the point of what was morale like amongst your fellow...
Ah, superb. They were the Bander brothers, no question at all. You got the odd one. I mean, some people couldn't take it. But they were not usual. The average fleet air arm pilot is one of the Bander brothers, really. They had a skill. They knew that, you know, whatever they're doing was particularly hazardous. I mean, you never thought of it as hazardous, but every deck landing was an accident that didn't happen, you know, really. You should never fly an airplane at five knots above stalling speed when you're going to the tail of a carrier, because if you lose it, you're into the back of the carrier anyway. You know, but you didn't think about that. That wasn't relevant until it happened, you know?
And how did you see yourselves? How would you have classified yourselves at this point?
As a pilot?
Amongst maybe the armed forces of that period of time, would you have classed yourselves as elite? Would you have said we're Navy pilots, or would you say we're just one of a bunch of people? Was there any of that element at all?
I was somebody because I was flying airplanes. I think that's the main thing. And when I could fly them, I was something again. So you go through stages. But looking around the services, I, without any question, think the Navy was the best. We were, you know, the old story, of course, about the RNBR. There were what the gentleman trying to be officers trying to be gentlemen, now they're trying to be both. And that was about it, really, because most of the intake for Fleet Air Arm boys were grammar school boys, in the main. A lot of the grammar school boys also spoke with a deep Yorkshire accent or a Lancashire accent, and that sometimes held against them. Sad to say, in the Navy, between decks. But apart from that, those boys who were in there, they were sharp. There's no question whether they spoke with a broad Yorkshire accent or Lancashire accent. Those boys were sharp. They were quick. They had to be, in the nature.